Access number 28653, Mr. Francis Lucas, Rail 5. Now, what happened when you got to Brighton? Is this where you were doing your preparations for the trip to come?
Yes, well, it was obvious when we got to Brighton that this was the final assembly before sailing, because Brighton and Hove was full of tanks, and not only that, they'd all been sand-coloured. And although we're supposed to have no clue as to where we're going, it's very, very obvious that with sand-coloured tanks, you're designed for the desert. And so with a brilliant deduction, we realised that. Now, I'd been to Brighton and Hove before on sort of day trips, and I must say that I was now quite shocked, because the whole very attractive beach of Brighton and Hove had been made defensive against, I suppose, any possible invasion, etc. I must say the whole place did look a mess.
What kind of defences? What can you say of them?
Principally, steel bars in the ground at an angle, so that nothing could easily roll up over the beaches. But
barbed wire or mines?
That I don't know. I imagine so. I should think so, because they seem to have it quite well organised there.
So now, what were you actually doing yourselves to prepare? You'd been preparing before by getting the lorries ready and the signals.
That's right. Well, as a matter of fact, we were allocated to some spare warehouses and so on, and were able to set up, again, a temporary workshop. And so there we continued our preparations, and in particular, I suppose, we got the feeling of working together. You know, with a team, it takes a little while to really get working smoothly together, and so that gave an opportunity. So, if you like, I call it fine-tuning of our workshop unit, and the opportunity to chat and get to know some of the lads of the other units that we would be involved with. So it was that sort of a time. On the social side, very pleasant. Most of us were billeted in seaside boarding houses. The landlady was very good. My wife was able to come down for a period of several weeks. We made good local friends, and the usual social links that we tended to set up. So, from that point of view, it was quite pleasant. But of course, we knew we were soon due to move out, and indeed, suddenly, at quite short notice, we were given a couple of days' warning to pack all our stuff and put on train for Liverpool.
Now, when would that be? You'd got there in January, you thought?
Yes. That would be round about April time.
Now, what? Anything about the journey to Liverpool? Or were you taking your lorries with you? How were they getting there?
Our lorries went separately. They were loaded independently, and we, of course, travelled independently. And didn't actually see our lorries until we had eventually landed, as it turned out, in Egypt. But it all arrived safely.
Now, what happened when you got to Liverpool? Which ship were you put on?
An old Cunard liner, a small one, the SS Scythia.
Scythia,
S-Y-T-H-I-A, I think, the Scythia. And she's a single-funneled boat, and not too large, and we were absolutely cramped on the Scythia. But Everybody was in good spirits when we got on and so on. I think a few families managed to get up and wave us off, etc. And so we were then formally advised that we were indeed sailing for Egypt.
And were you sailing in convoy, I presume? Oh.
Yes, I suppose we were. Strangely enough, I suppose that, as far as I was concerned, the Scythia was my world, and I probably look at it occasionally. Yes, of course, we were in a convoy. But we were on the boat for over 8 weeks before we got out to Egypt. And
now, what were conditions like? You said it was very crowded. Can you talk a bit more about that? What was your cabin called? Did you have cabin, or were you in a mess tent? What was it like?
Every spare corner under the decks seemed to have bunks. We were absolutely crowded. And that soon, of course, caused problems. Whilst the lads generally got on very well, but being confined in that restricted space did soon cause problems of one sort and another. And during the day, we were forbidden to go below decks. We had to stay up on the deck and so on. And that was rather better, perhaps. And things had got a little bit contentious between the lads.
Now, in what way? How was that showing itself? Were they fighting or just
in being argumentative? Occasionally in minor fights breaking out, that sort of thing. Now, forgive me for saying this, because I was still quite a shy lad, but it was strange, under some situations, looking back now, I was able to take initiatives, and I realized that things were difficult, and at that time, one of the popular programs on the BBC was the Brains Trust. And I decided one morning, well, look, what I'll do, I'll start a Brains Trust. And believe it or not, once I got a thing in my mind, then I didn't worry, and then I wasn't shy about it. So I got up on one of the higher decks, and shouted for the lads to come around, and I said, okay, we're going to have a Brains Trust, and so on. And practically every morning for several weeks, we'll hold this Brains Trust. That soon came to the notice, of course, of senior officers, and they arranged then for it to be broadcast throughout the rest of the ship, because we're holding in one particular area. And that helped considerably in that period of having some other interest, starting conversations going, and obviously was a bit of a help.
Now, how was it? I mean, people now don't really know what the Brains Trust is. I mean, people of my generation do, but people in the future won't, I suspect. How did the Brains Trust work? It's fairly obvious, but...
Yes, effectively, very simply, you would have a series of questions, and you would throw out these questions, and you would take in the answers, and where possible, if there was a facetious turn to the answers, you would exploit that and throw back queries and questions and so on. And a free-for-all, so that folk were able to hear their voices, say something, and express themselves.
Now, who would be on the Brains Trust? How did you select the brains?
Oh, I just did. In other words, a couple of my pals, plus I think we had usually four or five, and they were just selected at random, really. But it was an activity that at least gave an alternative to petty bickering and so on, etc.
Now, what route did you take? I presume you went right round.
Well, the Sevier soon ran into trouble, as you might guess from the fact he took over 8 weeks to get out there. And it wasn't long before we're on our own. And eventually...
Now, what sort of trouble did she run into? I mean, was this engine trouble or something?
Yeah, engine trouble of some sort. And obviously wasn't able to keep up with the main convoy. And so for a long part of the period, we're on our own. And then eventually, we limped into Port Elizabeth. And
where? That's South Africa?
South Africa. Yeah, eventually we got to South Africa in Port Elizabeth. And we were advised we would be there some time. I think we were there about 10 days. She then limped around to Cape Town. And at Cape Town, we disembarked completely. And the liner, the New Amsterdam, the Dutch ship which we commandeered, came in. We were transferred immediately to the New Amsterdam, which was a superb ship. And you probably know she'd just been completed at the beginning of hostilities and had been taken over by the Allied troops and pressed into service, of course, of the troop ship.
Now, you say you got ashore there. Do you remember much about that?
Well, all I can say is the local people in Cape Town, and indeed the time we're in Port Elizabeth, were immeasurably hospitable. They would line up in the mornings, and as you came off your ship, they would grab you and take you for the day and take you for lunch and other meals and take you around the place. So I must say the South African folk were hospitable to a degree.
Were you aware of the racial problems that they had in South Africa or any perception of it?
No, we weren't in any way. Because, of course, we were just on the very fringe of things. And so, unless you knew, shall I say, historically the situation, you were only concerned about your own personal local situation. And I think we all had very fond memories of our stay, both in Port Elizabeth and in Cape Town.
Now, what happened next then? You boarded the New Amsterdam and continued your journey.
That's right, yes. And I think it was only about a week's journey, quite a short time, then up to Suez, was it, where we disembarked for Egypt. Yeah, so that was a luxury ending, really, the New Amsterdam.
It was less less crowded, was it?
Was my goodness, well, it was so large, so big. The city was just a small Cunard liner with one funnel ship, and there was all the difference between a clapped-out Ford and a Rolls Royce, put it like that.
And so what happened when you got to Port Suez, you think?
There we were taken to a camp,
a transit camp.
A transit camp, yes. Taken to a transit camp, where eventually we were reunited with our vehicles, and we then sorted ourselves out, got back to our vehicles and sorted those out, and then fairly soon we moved.
That transit camp was close to Port Suez, was it?
That's right, yeah, transit camp there somewhere in that area. Just where now, I wouldn't be able to put my finger on it.
Now, what about, what were your first impressions of Egypt, the climate, the people and the rest of it?
Well, our first impression of Cairo, of course, was utterly confusing, because it was crowded to a degree, and we were accosted continually by the locals, who would either try to sell us something or take us somewhere, etc. And it didn't give a very good impression. But after a while there, one was able to sort out more acceptable places, some of the hotels and other places, and there were YMCAs there. So I would think we were around Cairo for about 10 days.
Now, what did the YMCAs offer in Cairo? What was the YMCA set up like?
Very similar to YMCA everywhere. Usually one big assembly room, if you like, a relaxed room with refreshments available, tea, coffee, cakes, what have you. And usually, again, there would be a couple of writing rooms. And it was a fairly standard formula.
They weren't actually They weren't actually hostels. They were just sort of meeting places.
Yes. It was. There probably was hostel attached, but not a hostel for us. No sleep facilities. But the refreshment and social facilities, they were quite a haven, etc. And of course, many of the lads found other places you might well guess, etc. Let in the field hall.
Now, so you were in the Cairo area for about 10 days. This is, what, June 42?
It would be, wouldn't it?
Roundabout.
It would be roundabout that period by that time. Yes.
And what happened next?
And then we moved up. We stopped a while, I think, in the Alexandria area as we were moving up. And then again, we had a break there, because I remember we had trips to the pyramids, etc.
I think Alexandria's, the pyramids are nearer Cairo.
Yes, so that would be then between Cairo and Alexandria, etc. And then, of course, up in the desert itself.
Now, what were desert conditions like? I mean, what did you think of the desert?
Well, of course, you're limited to your truck, which became your workshop and your home and your living centre, where that's concerned. And I suppose we adjusted remarkably quickly. It was, I remember, very hot indeed, and it took us a while to adjust to that and to be sensible enough to protect ourselves from the heat. And there was the old joke about frying eggs on the outside of your vehicle or tank due to the heat, etc.
Did you suffer much yourself from the heat? Some people do.
Fortunately not. No. I found it, of course, very hot, but I didn't suffer unduly from it. The main pest were the flies. We've never seen so many flies in our lives, and we're all issued with fly swats. And one of the relaxations, we were in shorts, was to sit down comfortably with a cup of tea and your fly swat, and the flies will come and land on your legs, your knee, and so automatically swap them with the fly swat as you're chatting and drinking a cup of tea. And then after a period, around the bottom of you, there was a whole lot of dead flies. And there was an instruction, if I remember rightly, that... And so there's instruction coming out that we should kill so many flies per day. And it had been calculated if every member of the forces there killed with, say, 100 flies a day, then the total flies killed would be so much and we would get it under control. That was someone's bright idea. But certainly we did kill lots of flies, almost as a social relaxation, and because they were a darn nuisance.
How were they a nuisance? I mean, just to explain to them, I mean, how many were there? What did they do that was so irritating?
Oh, well, just the fact they would land on any exposed bit of you, they would irritate you, and if you were eating anything, of course, you would hold it in one hand and wave the other hand to keep them away from your biscuit or sandwich or whatever you're having, and so on.
Now, the flies are inextricably connected with, dysentery or upset tummies, you know, because they spread disease and germs. Was there much trouble with upset tummies or of any sort? Early days?
That's very interesting. I'm not aware of it being a very great problem. There were upset tummies. I was fortunate. I didn't suffer any. But I wouldn't say, where we're concerned, that it was an epidemic or it was excessive in any way, which, thinking back, is somewhat surprising. But no, that wasn't a major problem where we were concerned.
So what about your health generally? Was that good?
At that time, yes. I personally felt pretty well. I would say, so health or tiredness was not really a problem at all.
What about food? What were you eating in the desert?
There we did have a very good catering group, and as far as I remember, the diet was quite reasonable. Basically, of course, plenty of potatoes and so on. Chips, the usual stuff, and tinned beef, etc. I forget precisely, but my memories are not of a poor diet at all. It was obviously adequate, and I would think that we probably fed very well indeed.
What about water?
At that stage, no problem. We have water problems, of course, later. But then there's no problem.
So what about driving in the desert? I mean, I don't know whether you were actually driving your thing at all, but what were driving conditions like? Because obviously you'd be doing a lot of that.
Yes. Well, fortunately, you had your beaten tracks. And when it got off the beaten tracks, it just depended. And you soon got used to the vehicles, particularly the workshop lorries, bogging down the sand, having to get out and put the sand channels under the wheels and digging them out, and that could be a problem. But again, a lot improved with experience. Our lads soon knew how to spot out the soft parts of the sand and, if possible, avoid them. But indeed, at first, that could be a hard business, driving with the soft sand, etc.
Did you drive?
Yes, we all took it in turns, and I was very keen to drive, quite frankly. And I soon had my own personal truck allocated. And
Now, was that a repair? A workshop truck, or was it just an ordinary truck?
No, just an ordinary truck for getting around and about. We had our workshop truck and a couple of other associated trucks, but I had my own personal one. And I did have a driver, and the driver was a lad named Dick Turpin, and Dick Turpin was the brother of Randolph Turpin, who at around about that time was the world sort of middleweight champion or something. Dick himself was a boxer, and as I've commented elsewhere, Dick often caused more problems than the whole of the army in many ways.
What was your relationship like with Dick Turpin?
Variable. He could be irritating to a degree, and in particular, because of his, with due respect, extreme untidiness, he would sometimes want to do some pastry making in the workshop truck. He would clear off the tools and so on. He would have got flour and so on from the cookhouse, and he'd make pastry. But the irritating thing was he would never clear up afterwards when he made his cakes and so on. It was left to someone else to clear up. And he's quite a volatile character. Overall, I got on with him all right. But he was an irritating person.
What other irritations other than messiness?
Well, again, he would be wanting to slouch around and talk all the time. It was always difficult for him to do something positive. He would just chat and talk, etc. He didn't seem to be particularly motivated army-wise. And,
now, what were you doing as you moved into the desert? Where were you going?
Well, we were moving up to our positions, as we later learned, towards the Alamein area. And we were being positioned, as with the, at that time, the 22nd Armored Brigade, and we're moving into positions, but we didn't realize, of course, at that time, the significance of what was being prepared. Oh, what I should say, too, of course, Montgomery, not too long previously, had taken over in the 8th Army, and he had quite a significant effect, which I think everyone felt. He was unusual to a degree, quite unlike the normal senior officer that one had become used to. You would occasionally see him come up in a jeep, standing in the back of a jeep. He adopted, as is well known, not the usual officer's cap, but indeed a beret with a multiplicity of badges on. And he was unusual in every way. And he would see a group of lads around. He would stop the jeep, stand up in it, beckon them around, and give a bit of a pep talk for 10 minutes, and then off again.
Did you ever hear one of his...
He made himself visible, in a sense, and made himself, shall I say, a little bit unusual, certainly unusual compared with the normal senior officer. But you felt that he was in contact, and that he tended to know the lads and tried to get to know them. He wasn't tremendously apart and unapproachable.
Did you ever hear him speak in one of these?
Yes, I did. And he had that sort of staccato kind of voice, where he speak in a jerky way. And in a sense, he would speak at your level and so on. Yes.
Now, what sort of positions did you take up behind El Alamein or in the El Alamein area? I mean, did you dig your workshop in, or, you know, because they used to dig vehicles in into the sand dunes?
Yes, some vehicles were, of course, dug in, but no, we were in what you call the lager, in other words, in a group. I should think from the significant part of Alamein, several miles back, of course.
Now, what was a lager? How were you arranged in a lager?
There's usually one or two tanks on the outside of it, and the main vehicles were usually circular lined up around it, and you had two, your smaller vehicles and a few bivouacs around the area. It was a planned but fairly relaxed setup.